From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a critique of political correctness from a leftist perspective, we talk with Todd Gitlin, author of the new book Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars. Gitlin contends that identity politics is destroying our notion of the common good. Also, now that we're stuck in cold and flu season, we turn to Jane Brody, personal health columnist for the New York Times. She's written a new book about how to fight colds and flu. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Jamaica Kincaid's new book, The Autobiography of My Mother. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. House Republicans have held firm and rejected a move to end the partial government shutdown. The vote was on straight party lines on a move by Democratic leader Richard Gephardt to force approval of a bill passed by the Senate to end the shutdown while budget talks continue. House GOP leaders say the shutdown is the only leverage they have to force the administration to agree to a plan for balancing the budget in 7 years. In Colorado, a bank which serves mountain communities has made a move to help furloughed federal workers. From Colorado Public Radio, Teresa Schiavone reports.
The Alpine Bank of Glenwood Springs, which has 15 branches in western slope communities of Colorado, offered to advance federal workers their paychecks interest-free until they get paid again. Chairman Bob Young said in western Colorado, federal workers are not faceless bureaucrats.
Nothing was brought home more vividly than the Storm King fire, which happened here in Glenwood Springs in the summer of 1994, when we lost 14 federal employees that were endeavoring to save our community.
Alpine Banks have made $7 million available to federal workers in western Colorado, estimating about 1,000 workers will take advantage of the offer. For National Public Radio, I'm Teresa Schiavone in Denver.
Syria and Israel have resumed peace negotiations at a retreat in Maryland. State Department spokesman Nicholas Burns says the administration is hopeful that the talks will revitalize peace efforts between the two countries. The negotiations are aimed at securing a peace treaty based on Israel's withdrawal from the Golan Heights and new security precautions at border areas. A tornado ripped through a South Florida neighborhood today, injuring more than 24 people and damaging 100 homes. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
The tornado touched down in South Dade County during morning rush hour, packing winds of up to 110 miles per hour. The twister overturned cars, tore down power lines, and blew off roofs. At least 7 homes were severely damaged, and the wind blew a hole in the roof of a church. According to the Florida Power and Light Company, some 20,000 people were left without electricity. Most of the damage was confined to a 20-block section of the solidly middle-class neighborhood of Kendall. The area was hit hard by Hurricane Andrew 3 years ago, and the horror of that experience was briefly relived. When the twister struck, residents huddled in their homes, and schoolchildren dove for the floor. Like Andrew, some people said, the twister sounded like a roaring freight train. Afterwards, one woman sat in front of her home, crying. I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 23.5 points at 5,201 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, however, the Nasdaq Composite is down 9.5 points. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary William Perry got a first-hand look at the pontoon bridge between Bosnia and Croatia that gave Army engineers so much trouble. They had to fight cold, snow, mud, and flooding to get the span in place. Perry walked across the bridge, which is now serving as a major entry point for U.S. peacekeeping troops. Earlier, Perry visited the American headquarters in Tuzla. Testimony began today in Lumberton, North Carolina, in the trial of the man accused of killing the father of basketball star Michael Jordan. Eileen LeBlanc of member station WHQR in Wilmington reports.
In opening statements, prosecutors said that they had evidence that would prove that defendant Daniel Green shot James Jordan, killing him in July of 1993. The other man accused of the crime has since pled guilty, and attorneys say that Larry Demery will testify that he was an eyewitness to the shooting. Prosecutors contend that the two teenagers walked up to the car where Jordan was sleeping beside the highway. Green pulled the gun, woke up Mr. Jordan, and then shot him. Green's attorneys say that Demery was the one who asked Green for help in disposing of the body, and that Green was not even present when Mr. Jordan was killed. For National Public Radio, I'm Eileen LeBlanc in Wilmington, North Carolina.
A spokesman for Burundi's army says the Tutsi-dominated military opposes a proposal by the UN Secretary General to send guards to protect humanitarian workers there and to install a rapid reaction force in Zaire. The spokesman says those proposals would amount to foreign intervention. More than 100,000 people have been killed in 2 years of ethnic violence in Burundi, where the army is battling rebels of the Hutu majority. The University of Nebraska football team returned to Lincoln today after winning its second straight national football championship. Several thousand fans gathered to welcome the players. The Cornhuskers routed the Florida Gators in the Fiesta Bowl last night. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Conservatives have accused liberals of having a multicultural, politically correct agenda when it comes to school curricula. My guest Todd Gitlin has impeccable leftist credentials, but his new book argues that the emphasis on identity politics is hurting the liberal cause in America. His new book is called The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars. Gitlin was president of the radical group SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, from 1963 to 64, and he's the author of an earlier book called The 60s, Days of Hope, Days of Rage. For 16 years, he was a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley, where he directed the mass communications program. Now he's a professor in the departments of culture and communication and journalism at New York University. I asked him first to explain what is meant by the expression identity politics.
Identity politics is the belief that the central thing about you and what you think is some category that you belong to, either by birth, gender or nationality, or by later choice, let's say sexual preference. It's the belief that who you are or where you're coming from is the central factor in who you are as a thinker, as a feeler, as a live moral being.
You write in your new book that conservatives and liberals are following a standard script in the culture wars. Give us a sense of what you think those standard scripts are.
Well, on the right, we have the argument that America is falling apart, that group rights have replaced the rights of individuals, that the demand that America be totally free has turned into a sort of cultural wingding in which everything goes and it's impossible to believe in anything anymore. And the result is the corrosion of the family and the degradation of the American idea. On the left, or what is said to be the left, what one hears frequently is that the identities of oppressed people must be cherished, must be elaborated, that people have been subjected to discrimination as members of groups, and therefore they need to affirm that these groups are central to their identities.
Now, I have read many conservative critiques of political correctness and multiculturalism. You're opposing some of this from the perspective of the left. How is your more leftist critique different than what you perceive as the conservative critiques?
Well, my view is that the left is the affirmation of certain principles which apply to all human beings, that the left should be the preserver of the ideal of reason and the belief that people are capable of governing their own affairs. From a left-wing point of view, which I affirm, the insistence that difference is more important than commonality is a way of making sure that the left is politically powerless. From my point of view, the left should be articulating a principle which can be affirmed by a political majority. But from a left-wing point of view also, narrow-mindedness, dogmatism, censorship do not belong. And these are not ideas of the left. These are ideas of Puritanism and don't belong in the left.
One example that you could give of some of the new problems posed by identity politics is a series of textbooks that were recently released in the state of California, kindergarten through eighth grade. These were history and social science textbooks. You say that a lot of the opposition to these textbooks was on the cultural left. What were the charges against the texts?
The charges were that these texts were insufficiently respectful of minority groups or nations or cultures which were not Western. The charge was that they were racist, that they gave special pride of place to the experiences of white men, and so on.
What was your problem with these charges?
Well, many of them were false or were highly exaggerated, trivial. It was as if you were damned if you did and damned if you didn't. If you mentioned a person of another culture or another origin and did not bend over backward to indicate that this other culture was exalted, then you were charged with racism. If you, for example, as the charge singled out, if you said that people from Cambodia didn't know what snow was or were surprised to see it, you were accused of trivializing their experience when, in fact, you were simply reporting a fact. On the other hand, I mean, there were certain charges that were accurate. For example, the statement in an earlier version of one of the textbooks that John Wesley Powell was the first man to go through the Grand Canyon was obviously, I think, unthinkingly white-centered in that obviously he was not the first man, he was the first white man. There were a few examples of that sort, several examples. And the authors of the textbooks, who were themselves multiculturalists of a high and distinguished order, indicated their perfect willingness to correct the books. I should add that the books were written so fast. They were full of not only mistakes, but I would say a kind of MTV attitude toward fact. There was too much going on in these books. They were glitzy. The books were not perfect, but they were far superior to anything anybody had seen in California before.
You describe the authors of these textbooks as multiculturalists. What was their reaction to the criticisms by people of different racial and ethnic groups?
Mm-hmm. They were stunned. They didn't see it coming. Gary Nash, who was the principal historian of the book, came up to a meeting called by the school boards of both Oakland and Berkeley, and was when charges were leveled at him of racism, and so he didn't know what to make of it. He had, after all, been one of the first historians to write about American history as an interaction of red, white, and black, to use the title of an early book of his. He had been, while at UCLA, the chairman of the faculty committee in defense of the right of Angela Davis to teach when she had been excoriated by Governor Reagan. So he was astounded.
What is the importance of this larger fight over the meaning of multiculturalism and identity politics?
I think the left has squandered the bulk of its energies in recent years in a kind of cannibalism, shredding each other over microscopic differences, when in fact the larger situation is decaying. We have cuts in virtually every social service you can name. And instead of combining forces and declaring the fundamental values of equality and democracy, what passes for the left is squandering its energies in internal squabbles. You know, it strikes me as extremely poignant and painful that given the cuts that have come down from the Republicans in the recent budget fight, instead of combining forces to fight the school cuts, instead of organizing a million parent march, we have this sort of internecine fratricide, and this strikes me as against the best interests of the left as well as of the country.
I'm wondering about how multiculturalism and the politics of identity has affected you over the years as a university professor. You're currently teaching media and communication at NYU. You taught sociology at Berkeley for many years. Have you ever been challenged or attacked because of the curriculum, the way you teach it?
I've been challenged in a way that I think is healthy. I remember there's an episode I describe in the book in which there was a fight going on in the sociology department over the hiring of a person who happened to be a white male, and the graduate students were leading a class boycott. Again, I found there was something poignant in this, in that cuts were in force or in progress of university budgets, and fees were going up, and the students were choosing this issue to organize around. I thought that was a mistake, but nonetheless, it was an interesting mistake, and it led to some fruitful discussions. And I was teaching a course in sociology of culture at the time. And in fact, that week we were reading Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, and a student in the class, a black woman, raised what I thought was a very pointed question about what was my standing to teach this book when, in fact, I knew a whole lot less than the experience about the experiences of this character, the Invisible Man, than her grandparents did. And I thought that was actually a perfectly reasonable statement. It wasn't delivered with acrimony. It was a perfectly, I think it was an important question.
What'd
and
you
I
say?
Answered it by saying basically that as a reader of a book, one is always at some distance from the experience that the book invokes. The books are more than experience. Books are writing that connect with people's experience. And a great book reaches over the walls of experience and actually tells me something that I didn't know. I bring to it a particular experience, but also the rest of the range of my reading and my understanding. And I, in fact, believe that Invisible Man is not simply a book, although it is heavily a book about the experiences of a black man in America, but it's a book about a peculiarly American ailment of the incapacity to be seen, of the incapacity to feel real, the incapacity to feel connected to a larger society. Ralph Waldo Ellison, and he was named that way, obviously, after Ralph Waldo Emerson, was not writing a book for a tribe. He was writing a book for a nation, in fact, for a humanity.
How have you formatted your curriculum? I mean, when you're putting together the books to read for one of your courses, do you make sure that there's a certain amount of representation of women and African Americans and Latinos, and so that if anyone wanted to say to you, yeah, well, this course isn't going to mean anything to me because I'm a woman and there aren't enough women here, or I'm Latino and there aren't any Latinos represented in the books you're going to be reading?
No, I don't believe in that sort of formalistic decision-making. I think that there are subjects that need to be covered, and I believe in good books. Now, the course that I was just talking about, the sociology of culture course, mm-hmm. I had organized partly around the principle that what's interesting in culture is borderlands, people who are in contact with more than one culture and they're interested in the dilemmas of being in a culture. So, for example, in that course, we read, among other things, The Jewel and the Crown by Paul Scott, which is a novel about an Indian who doesn't want to be an Indian and an English woman who doesn't want to be an English woman. And that was a filter, a prism through which to talk about the problems of culture. I don't think we're all together so clear about what a culture is anyway. Cultures are always changing. And this notion that we know what a culture is, I think, is sort of fraudulent. But in other cases where I'm teaching a course on, for example, the issues of cultural export and the relation between American popular culture and the rest of the world, I certainly want points of view which are respectful of non-Western positions. But whether they're written by Westerners or men or women is irrelevant to me.
Todd Gitlin is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Todd Gitlin. His new book is a critique of multiculturalism and political correctness from a left-wing perspective. You describe in your book that a student, a white male student, freshman, came up to you a few years ago and told you that he was thinking of joining a white group. Tell us what happened.
It was a very poignant moment. I was teaching a big sprawling introductory class in sociology, but it was really a history course on the 60s and the 80s. And 450 students, you could understand how somebody would feel rather estranged in that class, and there weren't even any sections. An issue of financial shortage, by the way, which might properly be the concern of educational reformers. In any case, he came to my office one day. He was a freshman, and he introduced himself as being from the Central Valley, which is a not very cosmopolitan area of California, quite white, or at least the world that he'd grown up in was. And he had been approached and invited to join a group that was organized around whiteness, and he wanted to know, what did I think of that? And he was seemed to me sincere. I mean, he didn't come in a sheet. He didn't come muttering skinhead slogans. He was, I think he felt genuinely in some puzzlement as to how it could be that everybody else seemed to be organizing in tribes, and he wanted one too. I told him that I appreciated his situation. I appreciated that the question was reasonable, but to me, whiteness was not a category that was authentic. It was not based in experience. It was a defensive move, and I understand why he might feel in a defensive mood. But I thought there must be something better to do. So my advice was no.
Now, why do you think he wanted to belong to an identity group? He's a member of majority culture.
I know. It's a very odd thing these days. A reporter just told me the other day, actually, there are more people in San Jose organizing around whiteness or Europeanness or so on. You know, the truth is that Americans have always had this sort of multiple culture. We like to belong. This is one of the oldest features of American culture. Everybody wants to find a crowd to belong to. And now the world seems to have been parceled out that way. If you come onto a campus like the Berkeley campus, the world already seems to be pre-organized. You know, the world that confronts you is a world that's organized around ethnicity. Even if you're not comfortable with ethnicity, you feel you need a club to feel some comfort. There is at Berkeley, there has been for years, an organization called MISC, the Multicultural Interracial Student Coalition, because there are so many students who are the product of mixed marriages that when they come onto the Berkeley scene and they behold the separate organizations, they feel they need one of their own. And so it's simply, I see, it's purely human reaction. When the world is divided up that way, you know, you get yourself a crowd or else.
Do you have a place in your mind that's the borderline between a healthy and an unhealthy pursuit of racial or ethnic or religious identity?
It's a good question. I don't have a hard and fast line. I guess I have the Potter Stewart view of sanity here. I know it when I see it. But look, I mean, who's to say that people who belong to some category that means something to them don't have the right to affirm it? It's a question of balance for me. And how do you recognize balance? You know, you recognize it when you feel off balance, when the insistence on separateness stands in the way of people recognizing their commonality, certainly when it leads to the level of insult, acrimony, race hatred. Obviously, the line has been reached long before that. But even short of that, I think at the point at which people are so insistent upon their separate identity that they're unable to federate around matters that are deeply of their interest, it seems to me that the line has long since been drawn. And I would add here, Terry, and I think this is extremely important, that the most powerful identity-based group in America are the proverbial white men. This is the tribe that purports to be against tribes. But I find it disingenuous when white men are much more concerned about the plights, as they imagine it, of other white men, when, in fact, they might also be concerned about the plight of their sisters or of black people or Chinese Americans or any other group. I think that, you know, white men, the imperative is also for white men to take their commonality with the rest of the human species seriously.
You're not letting anybody off the hook.
I don't want to let anybody off the hook, including myself.
Since we're talking in part about the politics of identity here, I'm going to assume that there's at least one listener in our audience who's thinking, oh, sure, Todd Gitlin. He's talking about the politics of identity and multiculturalism through his own perspective as a white, male, Jewish, middle-aged leftist who thinks he knows everything because he used to be head of SDS in the 60s. So answer that listener.
Well, all of it is true. I mean, all the demographic facts are true. I don't think I know everything at all, but and I certainly have been instructed by my friends and colleagues of many different positions over the years. But I must say to you, Terry, and I think that listeners of all persuasions will know this, that sotto voce, aside, in their hearts of hearts, many people of every conceivable identity have looked about them over the last decade and have said, what have we done? We have painted ourselves into a corner. The people who are carrying on in our name are frequently dogmatists, are frequently turning away people who might be allies, are acrimonious where they ought to be respectful, and this is self-defeating. And when you look at the consequences of the 94 election, I don't see how you can avoid coming to the conclusion that the left has been barking up the wrong trees and hasn't seen the forest. So I think here that, in fact, I know for a fact that many people of many characteristics think the sorts of things that I'm arguing in this book. They may not have the whole historical analysis that I present there. We may have philosophical differences here or there. But I don't think that I'm speaking simply my identity. And in fact, I'm disagreeing with other people of the same identity. I really don't think that there's a one-to-one relationship between identity and arguments.
So what next? If a lot of people agree that identity politics has gone too far, how do you pull back?
I think what you do is you start emphasizing points of commonality. And I think that central to a position here is an affirmation of the importance of economic equality. We cannot, it simply will not do to retint the colors of inequality. When you have CEOs in major companies that make 187 times the annual income of the average workers in those companies, when you have the poverty rate that we have, when you have the well-known sinking or stagnation of the great middle class, it seems to me that it's possible to identify ways in which everybody could benefit. Now, some of these are going to be painful, and they're very much not part of the political discourse today. For example, progressive taxation. Horror of horrors. I think that there's a general stake in something like the raising of minimum wages. We have this appalling $4.25. Now that we have a revitalized AFL-CIO, and we have a lot of students who have to make these wages, it seems to me that would be a very nice issue for students to organize around. I think also housing, healthcare. I mean, there's a whole... I'm a traditionalist about what people need, what people are entitled to, in order to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it seems to me that there's a legitimate discussion about what exactly the points of commonality that deserve attention ought to be. But that's the discussion we ought to be having.
Todd Gitlin, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Todd Gitlin is the author of the new book, The Twilight of Common Dreams, Why America is Racked by Culture Wars. He's a professor of journalism and sociology at New York University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Got a cold? Got the flu? Not sure what you've got? Coming up, some advice from Jane Brody, personal health columnist for the New York Times. Her new book gives practical advice for cold and flu sufferers and for those who aren't sick yet and don't want to be. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Jamaica Kincaid's new book, The Autobiography of My Mother. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The holiday season is over, and we're stuck in the cold and flu season. Chances are, even if you're not sick yourself, you're surrounded by people who are coughing and sneezing. So you probably want to know, what's the latest thinking on cold and flu remedies? My guest, Jane Brody, is the personal health columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, Jane Brody's Cold and Flu Fighter, Preventing Them, Treating Them, What Works, What Doesn't. Sometimes you don't know what you have, so I asked her first about the difference between a cold and the flu.
They are both viral diseases, and they're both considered upper respiratory diseases. The cold, however, is primarily a respiratory disease. Your symptoms are respiratory. And colds are not dangerous, although they can sometimes lead to secondary infections, like bronchitis or sinusitis is the most common thing. And in a child, ear infections are very, very common, unfortunately, aftermath of a cold. The flu, on the other hand, is a much more dangerous disease. And the virus tends to have systemic effects. In other words, it affects you all over your body. You end up with aches and muscles that you didn't even know you had. You may have a very badly upset stomach and you can't hold anything in your stomach for a few days. And you have a terrible headache and a sore throat. But you very rarely have nasal symptoms with the flu. If you have nasal symptoms, chances are you don't have influenza.
Let's get to some of the things you can do if you do get sick that might help ease the symptoms. People always say if you have a cold or if you have a fever, drink plenty of fluids. Why?
Well, that is the absolute best thing you can do, because what you want to do is counteract the dehydration that results from your illness, especially if you have a fever. You become very dehydrated. And you also want to superhydrate the tissues inside your body in order to help them fight off the organisms. The drier your respiratory tract gets during one of these infections, the greater the likelihood that a bacterium can come along and cause a secondary infection. Why is it that people with colds often end up with these bad coughs, not caused by the cold, but sometimes caused by the treatment? If you take an antihistamine, for example, antihistamines, which are very fine for countering allergy symptoms, are really very inappropriate for colds and flu. And you'll find them in many, many over-the-counter cold and flu remedies. So I really do recommend that people look carefully at the label and find out what they should not be taking as well as what they might take to make them feel better.
What's the latest thinking on whether you should use medication to suppress a fever?
A fever is the body's way of fighting off infection. By raising the temperature of your body, fever helps to knock out the infecting organisms. So the better part of valor is to let a fever run its course, unless it is so high that it can be dangerous or it's so debilitating that, you know, you feel just totally miserable. So I think a fever under 102, you'd best leave alone. But when it gets over 102 in an adult is quite miserable at that temperature. You know, a lot of people will take aspirin or another painkiller like that to suppress a fever so that they can go to work if they have a low-grade fever.
Mm.
What do you think of that?
Well, I think if you have a fever, then you've got probably more than a cold, and you better stay home. And your body needs rest when it's under attack by these organisms. And going to work does two things. It doesn't give you the rest, and it spreads your infection to your coworkers. I don't think you're doing anyone any favors.
Now, a lot of the over-the-counter cold and flu remedies are what we call combination drugs, because mm-hmm. they have one thing to treat your runny nose and something else to treat your cough and something else to lower your fever if you have one. What do you think of the combination remedies?
Most of them are really counterproductive and possibly hazardous. I say possibly hazardous because you are taking medications for symptoms that you may not have or that may not be particularly bothersome and risking side effects from those unnecessary medications. And you may not be getting enough of the one ingredient that you need the most. A much better plan is to think about how you really feel. What is the symptom that's most bothersome to you? And get a single ingredient product to treat that symptom. So that if you are really stuffed up and you're very uncomfortable and my home remedies aren't enough to relieve your stuffy nose, and home remedies include using a room vaporizer and eating hot spicy foods or drinking hot broth, you know, like the proverbial chicken soup works very well, or tea with honey, and using a salt water nasal spray or nose drops. You can also take a nice long hot shower. And one of my favorite things to do, which wastes a lot less water than hot showers, is to fill the sink with hot, hot water. Take a washcloth, dip it into that hot water, and then hold that wet washcloth over your face repeatedly. As it cools off, put it back in the hot water and put it back on your face. And you can get a great deal of relief from stuffiness without having to take a medication called decongestant.
But the antihistamines dry you out?
They dry you out, and they are counterproductive. They dry you out, and they can allow other organisms to take hold. You want to keep everything fluid. You want to keep everything running. It's better to have a runny nose than a dried-out nose.
Any herbs that you would recommend for colds or flu?
Well,
herbal teas or you know, they have herbal capsules now as well.
Yeah, well, the most greatest value of an herbal tea is not in the herb. It's in the tea. It's in the fact that you're drinking a hot liquid. You know, there's one substance called ephedra that is used in some herbal teas. And there's a version of it that was very popular, I believe, among American Indians, Native Americans, called Mormon tea. And Mormon tea is made from this herb, ephedra. Now, but the thing that you need to remember is ephedra is a very effective decongestant. It is also the substance that is the basis for pseudoephedrin, which is the most popular synthetic decongestant on the market. Sudafed and Actifed all contain pseudoephedrin. So do almost all of the cold and flu multi-purpose remedies. So it is a drug, it is a stimulant, and it therefore has side effects. And you have to remember that just because it's an herbal tea doesn't necessarily mean it's a safe tea. There are other things that are potentially very useful. For example, ginger tea, and that was something my grandmother gave me when I was sick, and she didn't care what was wrong with me. She always gave me ginger tea, and I thought it was kind of weird, but I drank it because grandma said it was good for me, and I guess it made me feel better. It does help to get rid of chills, and it helps to relieve upper respiratory congestion. And, of course, ginger is very effective in countering nausea.
Garlic. Any useful things that you could do with garlic for a cold?
Yes. Garlic has, garlic is actually a wonderful foodstuff. And garlic has antiviral properties. And it if you rub it on an aching joint, it's supposed to help relieve the pain. It can act as an expectorant, so that if you have garlic in a tea or in a gargling solution, you may help to loosen up that clogging up mucus that's so irritating. Garlic also fights cancer and lowers cholesterol. So, you know, my theory is We should all be eating lots of garlic.
My guest is Jane Brody, personal health columnist for The New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with Jane Brody about fighting colds and flu. It's the subject of her new book. I want you to explain how an expectorant works, because a lot of people assume you're taking a cough syrup to suppress your cough, but an expectorant does something very different.
An expectorant loosens the mucus in your respiratory tract. It loosens it so that you can get it out. As long as it's there and thick, you are going to feel quite miserable, and it also will set the stage for a possible bacterial infection. So you want to loosen it so that you can cough it up.
When I was young and I had a flu, mm-hmm. I'd always get a shot of penicillin. No matter what, you have a fever, the doctor comes over, you get a shot of penicillin. Of course, we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. It's understood now that unless you have a bacterial infection, you shouldn't use an antibiotic, because an antibiotic isn't going to do any good against a virus. Okay, so we take fewer antibiotics now when we're sick. Nevertheless, sometimes a virus or a cold develops into a bacterial infection. Are there signs, without going to the doctor, that you can tell at home that will let you know that you probably have a bacterial infection and therefore you ought to go to the doctor because you maybe need an antibiotic?
Mm-hmm. Well, first I want to counter what you said, because the truth is that many people still take antibiotics very inappropriately.
Right.
And in fact, I have interviewed people who said, you mean to say, I always take an antibiotic when I get a cold. I said, where are you getting it? Because, you know, no doctor worth his degree would prescribe it. It's left over from something else I had. So they've made several mistakes. They have not finished a prescription that they should have finished for an infection that the antibiotic was appropriately prescribed for. And they are self-treating themselves for a viral infection with a drug that only is effective against bacteria. And at the same time, they probably don't have enough of it anyhow, but even if they did have enough of it, they are possibly setting the stage for the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in their bodies by using a less than adequate dose to knock them out. So this is not a good thing. Antibiotics can be useful. If you have one of those colds that seems to be hanging on for weeks, and you're either bringing up thick mucus or you're blowing out thick colored mucus, chances are you either have a sinus or a bronchial infection. And that's the time the antibiotic is useful.
So you look for colored mucus?
That's exactly right.
Bacterial infection.
Thick colored mucus. That is a classic sign of a bacterial infection that might benefit from an antibiotic. And the fact that you're still sick, you know, after 2 weeks, a cold should not be around for 2 weeks. You know, the standard line about a cold is treat a cold and it'll last 7 days. Don't treat it and it'll last a week. And that's really classic for a cold. Most people, the symptoms are gone after a week. If they hang on, and if you're getting sicker instead of better, or if you feel really dragged out, you may have a secondary infection, and that's when the antibiotic is potentially useful.
Now, what if you have a pretty bad cold or, any other kind of virus, and your nose is stuffy, you're all clogged up, but you have to take a plane trip.
Mm-hmm.
And plane trips, in the best of circumstances, can be hard on your ears.
Yes, and I'm one of those who suffered a ruptured eardrum.
Ooh.
On an airplane that I was asked to take right out of a sick bed. And it was a terrible mistake because I was then grounded for 6 months while this hemorrhage in my ear resolved itself. But what happens is that as the plane descends, the eustachian tubes are, you know, that are inflamed by your illness can't equalize the pressure between your throat and your middle ear. And as the plane approaches the ground, the pressure builds up and builds up and builds up. And then you can get very bad pain. In addition to that, seepage of fluid and blood into the middle ear. And that is a very debilitating. You get off that plane and you can't hear for sometimes a couple of days. You can't hear properly in that affected ear. I have several remedies for when you must fly despite having a cold. And the most important one is to take a decongestant before you fly. I would start the day before I fly and continue taking it through the flight and perhaps after you land, but also to use a decongestant nasal spray. And the timing of the nasal spray is very important, because where you get into trouble is when the plane goes down. So you want to use that spray before the plane begins its descent. That's usually the last half hour of the flight. And what I'd like to do is ask a flight attendant to inform me when we're about an hour away from landing. And that's the best time to use that nasal spray. But if you are uncertain about whether you're going to find out and exactly when the plane is going to land, any time within 2 hours before landing will be helpful. And you can, of course, use the spray again. You can repeat it if necessary during the descent. Chewing gum also helps. Stay away from alcohol. No alcohol before you fly, no alcohol while you're flying. This further closes those eustachian tubes and causes more inflammation and will, you know, sometimes make your ears close up when all you've done is go down in an elevator.
Jane Brody, I want to know if I should get a humidifier.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my predicament, and I'm sure I speak for a lot of our listeners. I have steam heat in my house, but it's very dry in there in the winter. I actually bought a humidifier a year or two ago, and I returned it because it said you had to go through this elaborate ritual to clean it, otherwise it was going to start growing molds and other bacteria. And I thought, well, I don't have time to deal with all of this, and certainly I don't want the humidifier to be spreading molds and bacteria around the house. So what do you think? What are my options?
Well, you know, this is a real debate about this, and I've written several articles about humidifiers. And my husband and I had the experience of having a humidifier, which I very conscientiously cleaned according to the manufacturer's directions. I even got to the point of putting a little chlorine in the water to keep down the growth of unwanted organisms. We had respiratory symptoms that entire winter, and it was only until I got rid of the humidifier that we got better. A much better plan is to spend a little extra money on electricity and use a steam vaporizer, because the steam vaporizer, when it's heated, it kills off the organisms. And so you're much less likely to have things growing.
Or what about pots of water on the radiator?
And pots of water on the radiator or wet rags.
Is it really going to do anything?
Sure, it'll do something. You know, and I also think that you should sleep with the window open, even at just a crack. If not just to get a better circulation of air, it's really important to get a better circulation of air. You know, there's always the risk of carbon monoxide buildup in a house, and you don't want to have to think about that while you're sleeping.
How has this winter been for you so far, Jane Brody?
Busy, very busy. And I try very hard in the winter to get a little bit of extra sleep. I think we tend to push ourselves. We all tend to push ourselves. There's so many things to do, and there are so many interesting things to keep us up late at night, and then we still have to get up early the next morning to do what we have to do. It wouldn't be a bad idea to try to get in an extra half hour of sleep during this busier time when flu and cold viruses are rampant, and you're all exposed to all these people who who may be carrying organisms. Well, you know, there was one thing we forgot, Terry, and this is really important, and that is washing your hands.
Yeah.
Colds are very often spread hand to hand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you shake somebody's hand, that's the time to wash your hand. It's more important to wash your hands after shaking somebody's hand than after going to the bathroom, I think. So washing your hands and trying to keep your hands off your face, because, of course, getting the virus on your hands isn't the problem. Your hand isn't going to get a cold or a flu. It's the fact that you then touch your nose or your eyes. And your eyes, although they are not an infected site, they are a conduit into the nasal passages so that you can transfer the cold virus to your eye. It gets down into your nasal passages, and you get a cold just simply from having scratched your eye.
What do you do when you're in a crowded train, plane, bus, or movie theater, and everyone around you seems to be coughing and sneezing?
I keep drinking more and more, and I do indeed, under those circumstances, and this is another trick I have for flying, is I take vitamin C in a large dose before I fly, and another one when I get to where I'm going. Vitamin C does not exactly prevent colds. You are just as likely to be infected with or without vitamin C, but it does seem to be able to abort many colds and to shorten the symptoms of many colds. It doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't work for all colds, but why take a chance? If you can get rid of the symptoms fast and fight that thing off, I think that's the better part of valor. So I take about 1,000 milligrams before I fly, and I take another 1,000 4 hours later or when I arrive. And that seems to be helpful to a lot of people. I have a few friends who, in fact, the former head of the Federal Aviation Agency had this problem of getting pneumonia whenever he flew on a long trip. And this was very devastating to him. My advice about drinking liquids, avoiding alcohol and caffeine, and taking vitamin C before and after he flew has really helped him a great deal.
Well, Jane Brody, I wish you good health.
Thank you. Same to you, Terry.
Thank you. And I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jane Brody writes the personal health column for the New York Times. Her new book is called Jane Brody's Cold and Flu Fighter. This is Fresh Air. Virginia Woolf once said that we think back through our mothers if we are women. But what becomes of a daughter who grows up without the love of a mother? That's the situation Jamaica Kincaid explores in her new novel, The Autobiography of My Mother. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Jamaica Kincaid's characters haven't got a sentimental bone in their bodies. The children she writes about are wise beyond their years, her adults aloof and mercilessly perceptive. In her short stories and novels over the past decade, Kincaid has waged something of a one-woman campaign against those old colonial stereotypes, which still thrive in travel ads, of the warm, simple, and jolly people of the West Indies. Kincaid's characters may speak in lilting musical accents, but their words always slice through piety and pretension to lay bare bitter truths. Zuela Claudette Richardson, the heroine of Kincaid's latest novel, is her toughest character to date. 70-year-old Zuela introduces herself to us by abruptly announcing the determining tragedy of her life. My mother died, she says, at the moment I was born. And so for my whole life, there was nothing standing between myself and eternity. At my back was always a bleak, black wind. The only image Zuela has of her mother appears in dreams, where she sees her mother's feet climbing down a long ladder, the hem of her white dress just visible. Zuela's lifelong yearning for her mother accounts for the confusing title of this novel, The Autobiography of My Mother. In telling her own story, Zuela feels she's also telling her mother's. In me, she says, is the voice I never heard, the face I never saw, the being I came from. Zuela recounts her childhood spent on and off with her father on the island of Dominica. When he remarries, she acquires a stepmother straight out of the fairy tale handbook who tries to murder Zuela with the gift of a cursed necklace. But the resilient Zuela eventually discovers black magic powers of her own, using sex to enchant a series of men. Her many pregnancies, however, end in harrowing at-home abortions. Zuela explains, since the one person I would have consented to belong to me had never lived to do so, I did not want to belong to anyone. I did not want anyone to belong to me. Like everything else I've read by Kincaid, The Autobiography of My Mother is lyrically written and slyly astute. Many of Zuela's canniest comments are delivered in the form of one-line zingers, such as this assessment of the man she eventually marries. He was like most of the men I had known, she observes, obsessed with an activity he was not very good at. Zuela's lonely life story also dramatizes the crippling legacy of colonialism. As a child, she's taught to mistrust her peers because in the eyes of their white rulers, they're shiftless and inferior. But Kincaid, I think, tries her reader's patience with a character like Zuela, who matures from an unloved child into an unloving adult. I became tired of Zuela's incantatory references to her mother's early death as the excuse for her own emotional aridity. I even found myself making a mental list of the throngs of endearing literary orphans, like Jane Eyre and Oliver Twist, who managed to muddle along just fine without mothers. Maybe because orphanhood is such a common fictional convention, it doesn't seem like enough of an explanation here for Zuela's shut-down personality. Zuela's life story begins with the loss of her mother and ends with the loss of this reader's sympathy.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new novel, The Autobiography of My Mother, by Jamaica Kincaid. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landrell, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Alan Tu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Kelsey Grammer, the star of Frasier. He developed the character of Dr. Frasier Crane on the sitcom Cheers. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.